I think I've said this before. I'll say it again. The older I get, the more I'm not sure that there was ever supposed to have been a professional clergy. Pastors getting paid for what they do, because it is so difficult to keep your motives pure. It's so difficult to stay in that place where there's an inherent conflict of interest and continue to make choices the way they're supposed to be made for the reasons that they're supposed to be made. And to be able to balance and distinguish between the crush of things that need to be done just to keep the building in place, the lights on and the roof over our heads and money coming in to fund all the things that are done, and really the purity of the gospel. Maybe Jesus had it right, you know, just an itinerant preacher who just kind of wandered around and did what he did. Because it's very difficult. Or maybe the Catholics have it right. Celibacy and monasticism and all that. Nah, couldn't be. It's just a matter of balance. It can be done. It's just difficult to do. And at times like this, when we're fundraising and, you know, waiting for money to come in, wondering if money's going to come in, wondering if we're going to have another year, happens every year. You know, for 6 years we've wondered if there's going to be another year, and there has been. So I'm trusting that there's going to be again. Don't know how, but it's going to happen. And these are the things that just take our attention and pull it away off of the mark. It's like the compass point or the divining rod for the water. It's vibrating. It's telling us where to go. But all these things are pulling us in all these directions, trying to come back to the center, come back to the mark. That's really the key of what needs to go on every single day. And some times of year and you know, some seasons in life, it's more difficult than others to do that. Last week, I know some of you were out of town, but last week for our Christmas service, we were talking about this issue of Jesus being born as a child. And to me, Jesus being born as a child is kind of the ultimate recalculation for us. It's the ultimate recalibration for us. And it's why I think it's important for us to come back to Christmas once a year, to Jesus as a helpless infant once a year, to try to understand the deeper meaning of what that signifies and what it means for us in our lives today. And we talked about the meaning of Christmas last week. We talked about, it's not about all the commercialism and all the things that we go through and the season of obligation and all the things that we do, but there is this deeper meaning that Jesus was born on this day. On this day, the light came into the world. The possibilities of new doors opening came into the world through him. But at that deeper note, because he was born as a child, helpless, dependent, vulnerable, it changes the relationship that he has with the world, that he has with us, that we have with him. And it's instructing us something really important about how we can conduct our lives and how we can keep centered and come back to center when we get pulled off in other directions. Throughout his ministry, Jesus was constantly telling us that we had to become like a child in order to be able to enter the kingdom. But the word that he used there in Aramaic is instructive to us. Talia means not only a child, but also a domestic slave or a bondservant at the same time. It meant both. That's typical of Aramaic words. They had to do a lot of double duty. Small vocabulary, lots of simultaneous meaning. The context tells you what it's supposed to be. This is one of those contexts where the two meanings of the word can be either both at the same time. It just keeps flipping back and forth. Because if you think about the qualities of the child, that complete dependence, that vulnerability, that sense of wonder and play, that sense of complete nowness, no concept of past or future, that ability to just accept things as they are, to just take things at face value. Yeah, there's a Santa Claus. Of course there is. You said so, you know. My little one who's 9 now, he's getting big, you know. No, there's no Easter Bunny and there's no Tooth Fairy. But Santa's real. Right, Dad? Santa's real, right? Taking things at face value, you know, watching him move out of that childhood into the adult that he's going to be, it's an interesting transition. Some things take a little longer to move than others. All those attributes of the child combined with the attributes of the domestic slave, the servant, the humility, the submission. And the most important thing is that in that servant's attitude, there is the element of choice. Because a child doesn't have a choice. The child is just what the child is. Hasn't developed enough to be able to do anything else than what it does. But the servant has a choice. Now maybe as a slave, the only choice is to serve or die, but it's still a choice. It's voluntary. The submission, the humility, the sense of service. You put all those together and you get a sense of what Jesus is talking about. This is the attitude from which kingdom becomes possible. We talked about how Jesus lowered his point of view. Lowered it. Just as we're supposed to lower our point of view. We walk around our lives 5 to 6 feet off the ground, most of us. There's a few shorties. But most of us are walking around 5 or 6 feet off the ground. You know, when if you have a child and the child loses something in the house, you know how you find it? Get down on your hands and knees because you will see things from 2 to 3 feet off the ground that you'll never see from 5 to 6. Little hiding places and crevices where that thing goes. To lower our point of view changes everything about the way that we view life. It changes it. And Jesus is saying without that change, without that literally born-again experience that drops our point of view down to the level of the child, we cannot enter the kingdom. Because all the things that we're thinking about and all the things that we obsess over and all the things that we're striving for from 5 to 6 feet off the ground have nothing to do with what's really important at 2 to 3 feet off the ground. Jesus is trying to get that through our heads. He showed us with his very birth. And not only was he born as a child, he was born lying in a manger. No fanfare, no wealth, no authority, no power. The people of his day would have walked right past him. And if we're not careful, we'll walk right past him too. Looking for what we think the king should look like. Looking for what we think the Savior should be like. And missing the fact that he's unassuming. On purpose. Unassuming. Humble. He didn't come to be served. He came to serve. He washes our feet. It changes everything. If we really think about the meaning of Christmas, what Christmas is trying to remind us every single year is we need to lower our point of view. We get distracted for 12 months. We get our heads up at this level where we're thinking about all these details and all these things that need to get done. And we're no longer enjoying the ride. We're no longer having fun. We think we have to do it on our own. We have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and make things happen rather than realize our essential dependence and vulnerability. And the fact that we really don't make much of anything happen. We can't even make our next breath happen. Christmas is trying to bring our point of view back down to earth, back down to a place where we can reconnect. I guess in a sense, Jesus was born as a child and then he never grew up, right? He stayed with that childlike quality. Or you know what I was thinking? Maybe he did grow up. Maybe he did grow up. And then maybe he had to unlearn the things that he learned. Because otherwise, what was that experience out in the wilderness all about? What was he doing out there for that symbolic 40 days? It wasn't 40 days, I guarantee you that. There's 18 unaccounted years in Jesus' life, from age 12 to age 30 or thereabouts. That time in the wilderness was a long time for him. Sometimes people ask me about Paul. Most scholars say there's probably 14 years between Paul's Damascus experience and his first missionary journey. A long time in the wilderness. Trying to do what? I believe it's trying to drop your viewpoint down. We are so wired to go after greatness. We are so wired to accomplish things. We are so wired to respect and celebrate those who do rise above the crowd. Far beyond 5 or 6 feet. They're way up in the stratosphere someplace. And if you think about the temptations that Jesus faced in the wilderness, every single one of them was an offer for greatness and a pushing back away. Change these stones into loaves. Push back away. Bow down before me and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world. Talk about greatness and he pushes away. Throw yourself down from the pinnacle of the temple in view of everyone and be borne up by angels to be awed, to be celebrated, and he pushes back away. Maybe Jesus did grow up. And then in the desert, he learned, unlearned, relearned to come back down and to become childlike again and to view life from 3 feet tall. Because that's what he has to give us. That's his message. That was his message then. It's his message now. It jumps off the pages of the New Testament. If we care to look with every breath that he forms words with, he's trying to get us to drop our point of view to the Father's. And this is the most mind-blowing thing for me of all. Jesus is childlike. Jesus is servant-like. Jesus washes our feet, and he's one with the Father. The Father is childlike. The Father is servant-like. The Father washes our feet. We got to see this. We got to see the radical, outrageous nature of what Jesus is trying to tell us. Through his birth, his life, his words, it's all there. And some of this really flies in the face of what we were taught about Jesus. How could Jesus, you know, have to unlearn things? How did Jesus have to learn things at all? You know, maybe you don't believe that. That's okay. Whether he never grew up and stayed a child or whether he had to relearn it, the point is we have to. And the form is there. The path is there for us. We can see what it looks like in Jesus' life and in so many others that have followed him. If we're not on that path, if we're not taking that path, then we will not be able to experience that born-again-ness, that change of point of view that transforms the way that we look at the world. This is so hard to do. Gosh, it's hard to do. You know, I spent 10 years banging away, I mean, really hard, as a pastoral student and as a self-student, trying to figure out what this gospel was all about. And banging and banging and banging because I was constantly looking for greatness. I was trying to build something. I wanted to do great things for God. I was trying to find out God's will for my life. You know, this plan that was going to take me someplace. And I looked at all these ministries, these great ministries, and I wanted to be a part of that, you know. If not be a part of it, start my own something. I wanted to do all these great things. And I was still just as neurotic after 10 years as I was when I started. Because I was looking in the wrong direction. I was actively going against the very thing that Jesus was trying to get me to understand. I don't know what your Christmas was like, but mine was really interesting. It was kind of quiet, which was good. Christmas Day, we stayed home, and four of Marion's relatives from Oregon came down, and so we spent the day with them, and then the next day we went out to Marion's parents' house in Cherry Valley, which is out by Beaumont and Banning, so it's like an 80-mile drive, an hour and a half out there into the hinterland. And then we're sitting there with, you know, there's, I don't know, 17, 18 people there, you know, kids and adults, and we're sitting around this L-shaped table, and you know, the prophet is never honored in his home, you know. Nobody cares. I'm a pastor. They know I'm a pastor. They don't care. I say the perfunctory prayer at the beginning of the meal, and that's about it. Then everybody takes off, and they're doing their things. And if you don't fight for position and for something to say at the table, man, you just kind of get left by the wayside because it's stream of consciousness there, you know, just subject after subject. And so I tend to, you know, my inner introvert comes out, and I just tend to kind of hang back and sit. And I'm just watching this whole thing, you know, watching all of the connection, all of the interaction, you know, of the couples and how they interact with each other and how they're interacting with the rest of the group and who was gregarious and speaking out. My daughter brought her new boyfriend, which is going to be the one, right? And but he's very outgoing, and he was jumping right in there and getting his licks in and talking, and I'm watching him and I'm watching her with him. It's so fascinating to watch my 22-year-old starting to act like a woman, you know, and having this man that she's serious about, and then watching, you know, Marion's brother and his wife and their interaction and the patriarchs. It was just fascinating to me, and I'm just sitting there watching all of this. And it's dawned on me, this is what matters. This is what's important. It's the relationships. It's enjoying all of that interaction, even the dysfunction and the craziness and watching the things that are playing out. Just enjoying the fact that you're part of this family. That you got a place at the table. You know? That everybody knows your name. That you have a door that you can go knock on and it opens and it smells like food and Christmas in there. And you got a place to go to have those things. That's it. What else do we take with us? And yet, even though I can try to express these things to you, and I believe that they're true, you know, to my socks, at the same time, I fight against it on a daily basis because I still want to do that great thing. You know, I still want to build that thing. You know, and I can still find myself getting envious of someone else who's built this and that and wondering why haven't, you know, all of that craziness in the head, it's still there. But on a day-by-day basis, I'm getting better and better at valuing what's really important. And that means a lot to me. Because I spent so many years chasing so many things. You know, it's a hard lesson to learn. What helps us learn it? I don't know. Maybe it's just getting old and not being able to do the things I used to be able to do. I'm not really sure. I can't stay up as late. I can't work as long. It's just like, man, I'm just running out of steam. Maybe that's it. That's okay. That's okay with me. I don't think it matters how we get here, how we get there, where Jesus is trying to take us. Just get there. You know? Be like her. That's perfect. Just walks right out. Comes with grandma and grandpa. That's it. Can we do that? Can we see life from her viewpoint? See what's really important. These are the things that Jesus is trying to get us. You know, this is the narrow gate. We talked about this the week before. Jesus said there's a narrow gate and a narrow way behind it, and few people go that way. Most people take the broad path that leads to destruction, but the way and the gate to life are constricted. They're narrow, and few people go that way. And of course, we as a church and we who've inherited church teachings for 2,000 years, we think that's heaven and hell. That few people are going to heaven and the rest are all going to hell. This has nothing to do with that. Jesus' teaching is all in the context of kingdom. Kingdom is all in the context of the here and the now. Kingdom is not heaven. Kingdom is this quality of life we can have right here and right now when we can start to look at life from 3 feet off the ground. It happens all here and now. But few people will ever go there because few people are not willing. Few people are willing. Let me get my negatives happening here. Few people are willing to let go of this quest for greatness, this striving for greatness, not only in ourselves but in others. Look at our celebrity culture. What's that all about? Why do we run after celebrities? Why do we want their autographs? Why do we want to be near them? Why do we want to take a picture with them? Why is reality TV so big? People think that if they could just get on TV, then some of this rubs off on them, that somehow meaning and purpose come from how many people know your name that you've never met, how many hits that you get on your website, how many people are following your tweets. Is this really what it's about? Is this significance? But we do these things. We run after these things. And even in a church setting, we revere the prophets. We revere these people who have written books and all these people who have risen head and shoulders above the crowd. We chase down, oh, I got to go see him. You know, oh, this person is speaking and we got to go there. You know, running around, revering that elevated position. It's the opposite of that. It's taking that whole thing and turning it upside down. How many of us are willing to do that? How many of us can really see what Jesus is trying to tell us? We have to completely rewire our heads because we think of Jesus as a celebrity, don't we? I mean, think about it. We picture him tall and beautiful with the long hair and the piercing blue eyes. And I mean, you fill in the blanks of how you see him physically, but I guarantee you he's attractive in your thoughts. He's mesmerizing in your thoughts. You know? He's someone that you want to run to. There's nothing wrong with that. That's why we follow him. The problem is, would you know him if you saw him, or would you run right by him to get to Justin Bieber? Because he looks like what you expect. I mean, it's so fascinating to me. Jesus was born in a manger. The people seeking greatness of his day never, ever would have gone to Bethlehem. They never would have gone to the Galilee. What good comes out of Nazareth, Nathanael asks. Right past him. Isaiah tells us there's no beauty in him, that we would be attracted to him. Are we ready to see Jesus as he is really laying himself out, that we would know him when we saw him or when we walk on by. And now here's the other question. How do we do what Jesus did? Can we do what Jesus did? If we don't, how are we ever going to know him when we see him? On the other hand, he was Jesus and I'm not. Can I do what Jesus did? Well, he told me he could at John 14. If you believe on me, you will do the things that I do and greater things than these. He tells his followers, he tells us. This path that he has worn for us, this path that he has showed for us, is a path that he expects us to take ourselves and not somehow vicariously have dropped on us because we say we believe something. We need to take the path. We need to risk the things that need to be risked. We have to be willing to be, you know, disoriented, discombobulated, and really thrown for loops if we're going to get to the other side to see life from 3 feet off the ground. This is what I think Jesus is driving to in the next passage at Matthew 7, 15 to 20. He says, "Beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then you will know them by their fruits." Now that follows directly out of the discussion of the narrow gate and the narrow way that few people will go by. Most people going by the other path. Now he's talking about these false prophets. Few go by that narrow way because they're looking for greatness. Who were the celebrities of the first century in Judea, in the Galilee? Who were the celebrities then? It was the Pharisees and the scribes. It was the Sadducees. It was those who held all the levers of power in their society. Yeah, there was the Roman occupation, but within that Judean, within that Jewish culture, the top of the pyramid were the Sadducees who ran the temple, the scribes who interpreted the law, and the Pharisees who were the teachers of the people in that law. They were the ones. They were celebrities. They were the top. Everybody looked at them and recognized them. Recognized them by their clothing. Recognized them by their bearing and their stature. Recognized them because they would pray on the marketplaces and do all the things that were righteous in, before the people. And so Jesus is saying, these people, you know, these are the ones that you are running to. But beware. Beware. Now, this image that he's using of the sheep and the wolves works simultaneously on several different levels. And I think it's helpful for us to take a look because they're all going to speak to us in some way. First of all, the sheep. Now, sheep are really dumb. They're really docile, you know. They can be led around very easily. But they're also symbols of vulnerability and symbols of dependence and symbols of harmlessness. They're also the staple of life in that culture. For their wool, for their skins, for their meat, everything about them. That's why the flocks were raised, because they were a staple of life. They preserved life. Without them, life didn't continue in that culture. Wolves, on the other hand, they're the top of the food chain. They're the predators. In that culture, they were completely wild, of course. They preyed upon the flocks. The shepherds had to guard the flocks against the wolves. But they were dangerous to humans, too. They were pack hunters, intelligent. They had strategies. They would get you. You had to watch out for the wolves, but they are at the top of the food chain. So Jesus is taking these things and putting them into connection. The sheep have the power to preserve life. The wolves have the power to take it away. Remember the whole thing about the loaves and the stones? You know, if your son asks you for a loaf, will you give him a stone? If he asks you for a fish, will you give him a snake? If he asks for an egg, will you give him a scorpion? And we were talking about how in that culture, these things that seem so separate to us visually actually were similar. The stones and the loaves would look similar from a distance. You know, a fish and a water snake in the water would look similar. But one has the power to give life and one has the power to take it away. And what Jesus is saying is we have to be able to discern between the two. It's like when he curses the fig tree. From a distance, it looks like it should be full of fruit and preserve life. On closer inspection, there's nothing there. An outward form, a shell, but nothing inside. Same thing with the temple. When he overturns the money changers' tables, the temple, beautiful from the outside, should be sustaining the life of the nation. But inside, there's nothing. Same thing is going on here. A wolf in sheep's clothing looks like it should be harmless, life-preserving, but inwardly it's ravening and it will attack you and it will take your life away. So he's trying to get us to understand we need to be able to discern, be undistracted, undiverted, know where we're going, to be able to see through. And the destroyer that is disguised as a life preserver, there's a message there too. Both sources within the New Testament and outside the New Testament talk about and describe the clothing of the scribes and the Pharisees. They wore long, overly exaggerated tallits, which are prayer shawls, long prayer shawls with tassels that were overextended, that were made out of pure wool. Or sometimes they were actual sheepskins that they would drape over themselves as their prayer shawl, as their tallit. Believe you, believe me. The people would not have missed this connection, you know? These ravening wolves who are covered over with the pure wool of the sheep's clothing or the skin itself. Later on in rabbinical tradition, it's talked about a deceitful man who hides under the prayer shawl to disguise his deceitful heart. And the tallit there is the symbol of the outward forms of righteousness, the outward forms of the law, following the law, following all the forms of righteousness, fasting and tithing and praying, but hiding underneath that deceitful nature. Jesus is speaking directly to the people about their leaders, their celebrities, the ones that they run to. Beware of them, he's saying. Because ultimately what he's talking about is beware of a return to the outward forms only, where there is nothing inside that actually preserves life. In Jewish culture, there's this huge understanding that the inward and the outward are supposed to line up, are supposed to match. You know, sometimes in recovery, we talk about the committee. You all know what the committee is, right? It's all those voices in your head that are constantly talking to you and usually taking you in wrong directions. Interestingly enough, the Hebrews had the same idea. There was a community of voices within that were supposed to mirror and reflect the community of voices without. In other words, your motives, your desires, your passions were supposed to be one with the life of the community. We're talking about integrity here. We're talking about the inside matching the outside. We're talking about our motives matching our actions. No deceit, no guile, no hiding under the outward forms and having other agenda or ulterior motives. All of that needs to connect. That's why Jesus is saying, beware of those who are returning to outward forms only. The Pharisees and the scribe were following the law, but they had cold hearts. They weren't trying to help the people. They were trying to gather power for themselves. Beware these false prophets. How will you know them? You'll know them by their fruit. And what's the fruit? What are we talking about here with the fruit? We got this image of the good and bad trees. You know, we can't see what's inward. We can't see what's inside. It remains unseen. But eventually what's inside comes outside over time. Eventually trees have to produce something or they're cut down and they're thrown into the fire. Now, good and bad in Aramaic, taba and bisha, really mean ripe and unripe, mature or immature. You know, if you read this section again and you put ripe and unripe instead of good and bad, it kind of gets you closer. So every ripe tree bears ripe fruit, but the unripe tree bears unripe fruit. A ripe tree cannot produce unripe fruit, nor can an unripe tree produce ripe fruit. Every tree that does not bear ripe fruit is cut down. That's the good and evil of the understanding. It either preserves life or it does not. Does the fruit of these people that we are either following or connecting with, are they producing ripe fruit? In other words, are they producing connection? Are they producing unity? Are they producing harmony? Are they producing community that is functional, that makes sense? Are they leaving people better than they found them? Are they a healing force? You see, the scribes and the Pharisees, for the most part in Jesus' day, were none of these things. They were a divisive force. They were pulling people apart. They were separating them from the presence of God by inserting themselves into that place. Jesus is saying, you've got to look at different things. Why were these men doing these things? Because their eyes were on greatness. Their eyes were 5 and 6 feet off the ground. They were trying to elevate themselves above the rest. And because they were doing that, and the people are trying to follow them, they're all going in the wrong direction. Jesus is saying, don't go to the outward forms. Change your point of view. Come back to the level of the child and see what is really there. See what's going on. So this good and ripe fruit, we know now, and we should know now, they're not deeds, they're not accomplishments, they're not the things that we build. That's form. It's not how well we perform under the law. That's form. No content there. Just like we've said in here so many times, God's will is really not a what. It's not the things that we do. It's not the accomplishments. It's not keeping the law or not, or marrying this person or not, or having this job or not. It's not about those things. The Jews had the idea of function over form. We're concerned with something, what something looks like. They were concerned with how it functioned in the community. God's will, instead of being a what, which is form, is a how, which is function. To function in community as Jesus functioned in his community is the center of God's will. It's how we live. It's how we love. It's how we look at life. It's the attitude that we have from the point of view that we choose that makes the difference of being in God's will or out, being in kingdom or not. Nothing to do with God's love. That's absolute. But our experience of that love has everything to do with all of these choices that we make. And so when you look over time at a person's life, at a person's ministry, at a person's teaching, what is the sum total? Does it bring people together? Does it leave them feeling better about themselves? Is it healing to relationships? Or is there something else going on? And not only that, how about the relationships closest to the person? Not the ones out there, you know, connected through a 24/7 satellite network. How about the ones who hang their toothbrushes next to that prophet? What are those relationships like? Can they be close? Can they be tight? See, this is the fruit that Jesus is talking about, these closest relationships. Jesus came lying in a manger. It's a huge statement, one that we miss. We put up our creches and our nativity scenes, and he's so cute, but we miss the deeper significance for ourselves. If it doesn't connect to us, then we're missing it. How does Jesus, being born as an infant lying in a manger, change our choices right here, right now, as soon as we walk out that door, before we walk out that door? How does it change the way that we operate? If it's not, then there's something wrong. We're missing the boat. Jesus is unassuming. Posed the question here at the beginning. Did Jesus grow up and have to unlearn? There's this wonderful story at the end of Luke 2 where Jesus is age 12 and his parents take the family with the caravan and all of the relatives to Jerusalem for the Passover feast. And Jesus is with them. And after 3 days, they turn around and they come back. They're coming back again. And they're 3 days out from Jerusalem before they realize that Jesus isn't with them. And imagine the panic that sets in to mom and dad to realize Jesus is not with any of the relatives. He's not in the caravan. It's a home alone situation, right? Jesus in Jerusalem all by himself. They have to make 3 days back. This is 6 days that Jesus is alone in the big city, in Jerusalem, like New York, Home Alone 2. He's there. And they search all over for him, and they find him in the temple, wowing and amazing all of the elders there with his knowledge of the scriptures and the questions he asks and the answers that he gives. And when his mom comes to him like a good Jewish mother and says, "Why have you done this to me, son?" And he just coolly says, "Well, you should have known where I was going to be. I have to be about my father's business." Think about that. Jesus was inconsiderate. Jesus didn't take into consideration his parents and their needs and their fears and their concern for him. He was doing his own thing. He was in his element. He was getting all the adulation and all the praise. Was there a time in Jesus' life where he could have given himself over to that? Well, the scripture tells us he goes home and stays in submission to them, but it also says he grows in wisdom and stature from that point on. He grows in wisdom. He learns something. And then at some point he goes into the desert and he completes that process in himself. That those praises of men and even the insults of men are not where it's at. The striving after greatness is not where it's at. None of that stuff survives this life. It's not what this life is about. It's the window dressing. It's the trappings. And it's not that good things can't be done through it. And it's not that we don't strive to do really well in the things that we do. We just realize that that is not us. That is not it. That those things that we do never, ever should take the place or supersede the relationships in our lives. If those things can serve the relationships, if those things can serve the healing and the connection that we bring to our community, then they're all good and they're all right in the center of God's will. Because the how is there. But if not, then we're a false prophet. If not, we are banging against the wrong door. If not, then our fruit is not ripe and it can't have any life-preserving effects. Jesus is saying, beware of these things. Remain undiverted. Drop your point of view to the level of the child. Overcome that need that you constantly feel by bringing yourself back. Every time you feel yourself drawn out there, every time you feel yourself being pulled away from relationship, come back, come back, come back. Whether Jesus remained a child or not, he comes to us as a child, both on Christmas Day and the day that he starts his public ministry, as a child, loving life, wondering after life, accepting things as they are, people as they are, in submission, in humility, in vulnerability, and he's beckoning us to do the same thing. Because if we can't, we're still loved, we're still saved, but we'll never experience what we can right here and right now. That kingdom, that connection, that ability to simply enjoy the ride. And that's what he wants for us, and it should be what we want for ourselves. Let's pray. Father, 2014 is right here. I can't believe it. Guide us through this new year, Lord. We just ask you to continue to guide us. Take our hands like little kids and lead us. And most importantly, help us to allow ourselves to be led. Help us to be willing to see things differently. Help us to be willing, moment by moment, to let go of the familiar things that we strive for and push back for a second and just see what it would be like if we just sit at the table and enjoy the relationships around us and laugh and smile and just delight in being a part of. Can we do that, Lord? Can you help us? Help us to see what's really, really important. Help us to see the unseen world that you inhabit and that you bring to us every moment. Father, thank you for another year. Thank you for another day and another breath. We love you because you first loved us. In Jesus' name. Amen. Let's all stand.